All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's September 1st,
and I'm recording you. I'm recording your conversations.
Everybody listen to that. All right, well, so thanks. This is on the test. This always calms everybody down. Okay. So we're just going to start talking about protein synthesis in chapter 3, and we're scheduled to have a test, I think, a week from today. And I don't know if we're going to get to that test on Tuesday or not, maybe. So you got to come to class on Thursday, and then I'll let you know how it goes on Thursday. All right, so protein synthesis. Let me see what I can do with some of these lights right here. Okay, I like this. All right, protein synthesis in the most commonly accepted form is the following. All right, and I'm going to tell you about the central dogma of biology. And a dogma is just something that you should believe in, all right, and not question. But of course, what should you always do, especially in science, is question, right? And science should be beyond the bounds of belief. It should be proven by testing hypotheses. Okay. So we now know that this is not exactly true, but this is a good place to start in your education and knowing something about protein synthesis. All right. The central dogma says that it is a two-step process. Do I have a previous slide? Oh, good. All right. It's on this slide, how many arrows do you see? Two arrows. So that means that protein synthesis is a two-step process. And that's never been contradicted for sure. And information always flows from DNA and is converted into RNA. The information is not lost. It's just converted into a different form. And then that information that is in RNA then gets converted into a protein. All right, so we have two steps. And where do you always find DNA? In the nucleus. So this first step of converting DNA to RNA always happens inside the nucleus because that's where we find DNA. The second step, right, where information of RNA is converted into a protein, happens within the cytoplasm. So RNA has to leave the nucleus and go into the cytoplasm. Right? There might be some proteins that are made in the nucleus we know now, but this is probably a good scheme to appreciate. And what can you tell me about these arrows? Are they double-ended or single-ended? They're single-ended, so they go in one direction. So information goes from DNA to RNA and into a protein and not the reverse direction. And that's a really good thing. Why do you think that's a really good thing? Why can't proteins that you eat change your DNA? Why is that a good thing? Yeah, because, for instance, when you go home tonight and have a chicken dinner, you're eating all those chicken proteins, you don't have to worry about waking up with feathers and a beak, right? So that's really a good thing. Because that information that's in that protein can't be converted and put into your DNA, right, and change who you are. So information only goes DNA, RNA to protein. So the basic concept is that DNA directs the production of proteins. And these proteins could be structural in their nature, or they could be functional. So the DNA controls what the structure of your body is, but also how your body functions through the manufacture of specific proteins. All right, so we got to come up with some names for that two-step process. The first step is what we call transcription. All right, and transcription is converting information of DNA into RNA. So tell me, what is the building block of DNA? Yeah, nucleotides, all right? What's the building block of RNA? Nucleotides, right? So it has the same building blocks. It uses the same language. These molecules are made with the exact same language. So you should think of RNA as being a photocopy of the information in DNA. It's the exact same language. And what do we call a photocopy of something? Like if you go to admissions and records and say, hey, I need a photocopy of all my records, what do you actually ask for? A transcript. So this process is what we call transcription because it's pretty much an exact duplicate. But you're aware that there's some minor modifications between the nucleotides that make up RNA and the nucleotides that make up DNA, right? It's missing one oxygen. in DNA, and the nitrogenous base is different, but basically it's the same language. All right, then that DNA leaves the cell, leaves the nucleus and goes into the cytoplasm. And then that RNA is used to make a protein. And I think we talked about the three kinds of RNA. Did we talk about the three kinds of RNA? The taxi RNA that brings amino acids to a ribosome. Ribosome is made out of ribosomal RNA. And the dictionary that explains how to make that particular protein is called the messenger RNA. So these all work together in the cytoplasm to make various kinds of proteins. And then, of course, you should be aware that a protein can have two different fates depending on where that ribosome is located. Who could remember anything about what a fate of a protein could be depending on where the ribosome is located? What are the two locations where a ribosome can exist inside the cytoplasm? Free ribosomes in the cytosol, and also as a part of a complex we call the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Right? So if it's a free ribosome, those proteins stay in the cytosol. If it's a ribosome on rough endoplasmic reticulum, those proteins go into the endoplasmic reticulum and then maybe move into the Golgi body where they're modified and then packaged in a vesicle, and that vesicle can be secreted outside the cell. So proteins made by rough ER are always going to be bound by some kind of membrane system or secreted outside the cell. All right. Now, this step of going from RNA to protein, right? How are we going to remember that name? What's the building block of RNA?
Nucleotide.
What's the building block of protein?
Amino acid.
So the language is different, right? You're going from a nucleotide language to an amino acid language. So what do you need to go from one language to another language, like Farsi to Hindi? You need a translator, right? You need a translation program to do that, or a person that can translate. And what about the information? Should the information change or just the language? Just the language. The information should stay exactly the same. It shouldn't be lost or converted or whatever. And that's exactly what happens in this step. All right, so we find ribosomes in the cytoplasm. So that's where translation takes place. All right, and genes are lengths of DNA that code for the synthesis of RNA. And that RNA then can be used to make a particular protein. So genes are information segments in DNA that are responsible for building certain proteins. All right, and that, remember, the messenger RNA carries that information into the cytoplasm on how to make that particular protein. All right, we got these two-step processes. We talked about that already. And the nucleolus is the active part of the nucleus that's making the ribosomal RNA. So it's a very, very active part of the nucleus. And the ribosome is what? The workbench where proteins are made on. So we got a couple concepts that I want you to become familiar with. The term genome refers to the set of all the genes that you might have in your body or that the human population has. All right. And what do these genes produce? What can a gene produce? They're responsible for producing proteins, right? So we could think of information in two different ways. We could think of information that is contained in DNA, and that would be the genome of our species or of you. But we can also think of that same information as not being in DNA, but actually being in all the different proteins that those genes can produce. And that's what we call the proteome, right? So the proteome refers to all the proteins that can be produced by the genome, right? So the genome will be expressed in our body as the proteome, right? So you should realize that the genome is fundamental to the proteome. That information goes from the genome into the proteome. Okay. Chromatin is a DNA molecule. And so it's just more than DNA. And DNA, remember, is a double strand. But it is packaged. Because if we were to take all of the DNA in our body and string it end to end, does anybody know how big a molecule that would be? Not just one cell, but if we took all of our cells and strung out the DNA, all right, it would be about 250,000 miles. Does anybody have an idea of where 250,000 miles will take you? It would take you to the moon. So that's pretty far, right? So that's basically the distance between the Earth and the moon. So that's the amount of information that's contained in all of the cells of your body. All right, so in order to get that to fit inside your body, those filaments have, those DNA filaments have to be very, very thin, but they have to be packaged so that they don't rip and break. And they're packaged with these protein molecules that we see right here, and those are called histones. All right, and so when the DNA molecule, when it's just a strand like this and it's wrapped up on these histones, we call that chromatin. Okay, and that DNA can only be used, it can only be transcribed when it is unpackaged from these histone molecules. And when it's packaged, it forms a chromosome that we can see underneath the light microscope. And we can even find DNA inside the cell outside of the nucleus, right, in this kind of form. When can we find DNA inside of a cell, okay, even when there's no nucleus in this form right here? For instance, when the cell is undergoing a reproductive cycle called mitosis, right? So when the nuclear envelope disappears, this molecule could become damaged. What would be the fate of the cell if it were to lose some of this information that's contained in chromosomes because the chromosomes got damaged? Yeah, it would mutate or it would die, right? So that would be very bad for the cell. But when chromatin is condensed, so when we see a chromosome, we say the chromatin is condensed, it's packaged, it's in a very safe kind of condition, and it's not damaged very easily. All right, so this is the kind of chromatin that we have when mitosis is taking place. But when the cell is in interphase, undergoing transcription, the chromatin has to come off the chromosome, and then it forms extended chromatin as a result of that. But extended chromatin can be damaged. And that's why in human cells, it's in the nucleus. It protects it from all the other stuff that's happening inside the cell. So if we have one histone molecule and some chromatin wrapped around it, that's what we call a nucleosome. Right? But remember, in order to use this DNA segment, it has to be unwrapped from these histone molecules. So euchromatin is what I call extended chromatin, right? And it's very, very light because it's all extended. Heterochromatin is highly condensed, and some parts of it might become permanently inactivated. All right, we're just learning more and more about this kind of stuff, maybe with different kinds of chemicals that we find in our environment or our diet, can actually deactivate certain kinds of genes in our body for the rest of our lives, and quite possibly we might even be able to pass that inactivation on to our offspring. So things that we do have consequences to us, but also what future generations as a result. All right, so we're going to, in order for transcription to take place, all right, we have to go from condensed chromatin, which is highly packaged but safe, via a process of acetylation. That means that a two-carbon fragment molecule is added to a particular part of the chromatin and it starts to unwind. So the chromatin is modified by adding a little two-carbon unit to it. And when you change the structure of something, guess what happens? You kind of change the function of it as well. So it starts to unwind and it reveals certain regions within the chromatin, right? So this might be the region here that needs to be transcribed for protein synthesis, but another molecule has to bind to this region right here before it actually can be transcribed, and that's what we call a transcription factor. And there could be various kinds of signaling molecules. For instance, there could be hormones that will signal acetylation of condensed chromatin and also act as transcription factors so that this gene right here can be transcribed and then eventually produce a protein in the body. So this is under control maybe of hormones and other kinds of factors inside the cell. All right, and when a cell has enough of this particular product that's coded for by this gene, then this gene becomes inactivated, the transcription factor comes off, and this segment of the DNA is deacetylated, and it forms, it goes back to condensed chromatin. Okay. But what I really want people to understand is that why do we have condensed chromatin? Because that's a very safe way to carry DNA around in our cells, right? As opposed to if it's in this long stringy molecule that's easily broken and lost. All right, so one gene, we used to think that one gene codes for one polypeptide chain. Each gene is, could be several thousand nucleotide pairs long. Right, we know that's true in many organisms, but not in really fancy organisms like the human being. All right, for transcription, there is an enzyme called RNA polymerase. All right, so RNA means that this enzyme is going to make RNA, and we call it a polymerase. If you ever see an ASC on the end of a word, a good guess is that that's going to be an enzyme that catalyzes some kind of reaction. And this is a polymerase, so it means that it's going to make a polymer. What the heck is a polymer? I think we looked at some polymers in the chemistry chapter. What's a polymer? It's a big, long molecule that has a repeating building block subunit over and over again. And that building block could be repeated 1,000 times or 10,000 times, you know, maybe 10 or 15 times. All right, so here is an enzyme that's going to make the polymer RNA from DNA. So RNA polymerase binds to a start sequence on the DNA molecule, and there's another enzyme that unzips the DNA, because remember, DNA is a double strand, so it has to unzip it to look at the sequence of bases in the DNA molecule. Okay, there could be other regions within this gene, which we call promoter regions, which regulates transcription, and then there have to be transcription factors that bind to that promoter region to initiate transcription, like hormones. All right, so how would you want to think of RNA synthesis? Well, here, what kind of molecule do we have right here? Double-stranded. And you got ATGC. So for sure, you're going to know that's a DNA molecule. And we want to look at a gene and know how that gene is spelled out. So we need to look at the sequence of bases in this DNA molecule. But the only way to see what the sequence is to unzip it. Right? So it has to come apart. Now, is that a difficult process to do, to unzip these two strands? I see some people shaking, yes, yes, yes. But how do we think about the difficulty of that? Well, remember, there are chemical bonds that hold things together. So what kind of chemical bonds are you aware of right now? You've got covalent bonds, and you've got ionic bonds, and you've got hydrogen bonds, and then you've got van der Waals forces. And can anybody remember the kinds of bonds that form between nucleotide base pairs in a DNA molecule? There are hydrogen bonds. And what kind of bonds are those in terms of strength? They're weak bonds, that's right. So when you have thousands of hydrogen bonds over the whole DNA molecule, that's pretty strong holding it together. But in one location, those hydrogen bonds are very weak. So actually, it's very uneasy to unzip and zip the DNA molecule back and forth in a particular region because hydrogen bonds are what? They're weak bonds, right? So it's a perfect kind of bond to use if you need to zip and unzip a couple molecules from each other. All right. So the gene is composed of a sequence of nucleotides, like in this region right here, it would be what, G, C, A, G, A, C, T, A, T, right? And of course, don't forget your base pair rules, which is what, G, C, and A, T. So that's the base pairing rules in DNA. And then the RNA polymerase binds, and then it's going to start adding ribonucleotides that base pair with one strand of the DNA. So now this shows, right, the base pairing rules for RNA. We've got GC, so here's, this is the DNA. Here's the RNA molecule that's being made. So what will base pair with a DNA cytosine? It will be a guanine, yeah, G in RNA. But now what about the adenine? in DNA. It has to base pair with a U. Yeah, uracil instead of a thymine. All right, so in an RNA molecule, you're never going to see a thymine. You're going to see a uracil base paired with it. Right, so that would be a nice dead giveaway that this is an RNA molecule and not a DNA molecule right here. Okay, and then when the RNA polymerase reaches a sequence that is the stop sign, it's kind of the period for making this RNA molecule right here, it stops transcription and it comes off of the DNA molecule, and this RNA molecule can then proceed to the cytoplasm so that translation can take place, which is the second step. All right, so if I was going to ask you a question, I'm going to get to your question in just a second. We see a step in protein synthesis on this slide. What step is this? Is this the first step or second step? That's the first step, and what would we call this first step? It's transcription, right? Because we're still using nucleotides, we're not changing language. And where do you find it? In the nucleus. Yeah, and I had a question up there. Roll right here, for instance?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Well, there in DNA, as far as I know, and as far as probably maybe anybody knows right now, only one strand is used in order to transcribe something. Okay? And so one strand is called the sense strand. That's the one that RNA is made from. And the other one here is just called the nonsense strand. Now, that might not be true, so don't be surprised if you ever learn of some important reason to have this nonsense strand there, but at the moment I can't say what it's really good for. Yeah? The RNA polymerase? Oh, the DNA, sure. Then it just zips back up again. Okay? And I forget if there's an enzyme that zips it back up, but there is an enzyme that unzips it. It's a helicase, because it has to unwind the molecule as well. It just can't unzip it, but it's got to unwind it a little bit. Okay. Yeah, and then the DNA molecule goes back together again, and then it's in a more protective, safe form again.
What triggers the unwinding of the DNA molecule?
Oh, that's an enzyme that adds a molecule to it called an acetyl group. And so it's called an acetylation, so it's an enzyme that adds a little acetyl group to the condensed chromatin so that it starts to unpackage and become extended. Yeah. That's actually probably a pretty important thing. That's a step in the control of transcription. All right, so transcription makes all these different kinds of molecules. We talked about the ribosomal RNA, the transfer RNA, messenger RNA. But in nice sophisticated cells like what we have in our body, right, there is something that's called pre-messenger RNA. And so when a pre-messenger RNA comes off of the DNA, we can see there's some light-colored segments and some dark-colored segments in there. And not all of this information is used for translation, okay, to make a protein. So in this particular case, these segments that are darkly colored are what we call introns, right? The light-colored segments are what we call exons, and it's only the exons that are used to make a protein. These segments are clipped out, right? And again, I don't know of any function of these intron segments, but there might be some function to them. And then the exons can be re-spliced together to make a functional gene that can be used for transcription. All right, so if we have this one gene right here, and we see that it's got three different segments right here, then we can figure out how many different proteins this one gene segment can make. Maybe it will just use this one exon here, or this one here, or this one over here, right? That's three different possible proteins that could be made from this one gene. Or maybe they're all just spliced back together. That could be a fourth protein, or any combination of these introns. So now we know that one gene doesn't necessarily result in producing one protein. One gene can actually produce a number of different proteins depending on how these exons are put back together in our body. And again, that's all under control of various kinds of signaling molecules. So the human genome has about 25,000 genes, and we know that it produces about 100,000 different kinds of proteins. So that means that on average in our body, one gene can code for three different kinds of proteins. And so the way that we use to explain why so few genes can make so many different kinds of proteins, we invoke alternative splicing of exons to explain how one segment of DNA can produce different proteins depending on how the exons are spliced back together again. All right, so it's good to have on the tip of your tongue like these bullet points or key concepts, and a key concept for explaining the production of many proteins from one gene is what? Alternative splicing, right? Alternative splicing. Here's just a slide that shows one messenger RNA that is being worked on by many, many ribosomes. And so here you can see many proteins that are being translated all at the same time from one length of messenger RNA. So this is what we call a polysome. Okay? So when the cell needs a lot of this particular protein, then this messenger RNA will stay around inside the cell, won't be degraded, and scores of ribosomes can attach to it and translate a protein from it. All right, so ribosomes read the messenger RNA three bases at a time. Okay, we call that the triplet code. So we have four nucleotides that make up a RNA. All right, and how many different kinds of amino acids do we have? Yeah, we have about 20. There's some minor ones, but we have about 20 major amino acids in our body. So if we just used a relationship of one nucleotide to determine what amino acid goes in what location, then we could only incorporate four amino acids into a protein. But we have, 20 different amino acids, so there has to be more than just one nucleotide to call for an amino acid in a protein. And what nature has worked out is a triplet code. So a sequence of three nucleotides will determine a particular amino acid within the primary structure of a protein. So this right here is what we call the genetic code. And this is probably one of the most amazing figures in your textbook right here. Let me explain the table a little bit and then why I think it's pretty amazing. Okay. So in DNA, we have a triplet sequence of nucleotides, which is TAC. And going from TAC to UAG, what's the name of this process? And where does it take place? Okay, going from DNA to RNA, that is transcription that happens in the nucleus, right? So thymine is going to base pair with adenine. Adenine will base pair with uracil because we're going into RNA, and C will base pair with G in the RNA molecule. This AUG is the start signal. All right, so this is always going to be at the beginning of a gene for translation. And that's what a ribosome is going to look for. All right, this AAA in DNA is going to make UUU in the RNA molecule, and UUU is always going to call for the insertion of phenylalanine in the primary structure of this particular protein. All right, so you can see that kind of chopped off the bottom of this chart right here. So there would be 20 different amino acids with a different kind of code. And this code right here is what we find on messenger RNA, not the transfer RNA and not the ribosomal RNA. So this is what we call a codon. All right, so this is what we call the universal genetic code because it's used not only in humans to translate a protein from messenger RNA, and not just in all primates and not just in all mammals, but basically on all life forms that we know on Earth use the same genetic code for translation. All right, so what is that evidence of? Okay, so you might think, well, gee whiz, maybe this was all worked out in very early life forms, and then as life evolved on the planet, since it was such a good system, right, nothing better had to supersede it, or even could supersede it. So this is some nice evidence of evolution. This is some biochemistry that we share with all organisms on the planet. All right, so let's see how this works. So here we have three different molecules. All right, on the top, double-stranded, what's that?
DNA.
That's DNA. And you could confirm that by looking at the nucleotides in this molecule right here. You know it's DNA because it's double-stranded, right? But you see what, GC and AT, and you have thymine and DNA. So that confirms your impression. All right, it unzips, and then it's transcribed. So here is the sense strand, TAC, which would be this one right here, T, and I guess there's an A and a C, right? So here's the sense strand. And this is making the messenger RNA. You can see the base pairing rules. T will base pair with A. A will base pair with U. And so this step of going from DNA to messenger RNA, we call that transcription, right? And now, this messenger RNA is going to be used to make a protein. The messenger RNA leaves the nucleus, finds a ribosome someplace in the cytoplasm, and in order for a ribosome to incorporate to make a protein, it has to look at a sequence of how many nucleotides in the messenger RNA. What do you see right here? One, two, three. A sequence of three nucleotides. We call that the triplet code. And in particular, since this is on a messenger RNA, we call that a codon. And if you look at the universal genetic code, what does that sign AUG call for? AUG is the start signal, but it also calls for the incorporation of a methionine. That's just a particular kind of amino acid. All right, and then the ribosome moves down to the next sequence of three nucleotides, the next triplet code, and what's it going to read? GGC. Do we have GGC on the previous slide? GGC. I don't see GGC. Okay. So in the second position, what is going to be incorporated? It's going to be a glycine amino acid. Is that what we have right here? Ah, thank goodness. It is a glycine. Okay. And then the ribosome does what? Moves down to the next triplet code, reads the sequence, which is what? UCC. And you can find your code sheet someplace, and the serine amino acid is going to be put in there. And then finally, right, we have this nice protein that has this sequence of methionine, glycine, serine, isoleucine, glycine, alanine, right? So this is the correct spelling of this particular protein as determined by the messenger RNA, all right? And then that protein just goes about its business, whatever evolution has figured out what it's going to do inside the cell. Okay, so this step, going from messenger RNA to a protein, is what we call translation. That happens in the cytoplasm, right? On a ribosome someplace, either rough ER or a free ribosome. Okay, so that's protein synthesis pretty much in a nutshell. But don't forget, what is bringing the different amino acids to a ribosome so that it can be put into this protein in the correct order? That's that transfer RNA. It's that taxi RNA that's getting an amino acid and bringing it to a ribosome. And that's what these guys are. These are just illustrations of what a small transfer RNA looks like. This is the end that binds a particular amino acid, right? And then this is the what we call the anticodon that has to base pair correctly with the messenger RNA. So remember, on the messenger RNA, we have codons, and what binds right here, right, will be the triplet from transfer RNA. Okay, and that's what we call the anticodon on the transfer RNA. Here's just a pretty nice graphic that shows the three different kinds of RNA, the messenger RNA that's moving through the ribosomal RNA, and then the different transfer RNAs that are bringing in amino acids that will be used to form peptide bonds to make this protein right here. Okay. All right, we talked about this already. This is a rough endoplasmic reticulum that has a ribosome on it. And as the protein is being made, you can see it is what? It is placed inside this membrane complex. And so now it's trapped inside this membrane. And so its fate is to stay with inside a membrane, maybe within a vesicle inside the cell, or maybe this vesicle is going to fuse with the plasma membrane and will be secreted from the cell. Okay. All right, DNA replication is the term we use to talk about how a cell makes more chromosomes. All right, we could say duplication, but we don't really use that term. We use replication. So when a cell divides via process of mitosis, it has to replicate DNA. And there are some enzymes. Here's a helicase once again that breaks the hydrogen bonds to produce two free strands of DNA, so that unzips the DNA molecule. And then there's going to be another enzyme that makes a big polymer of DNA. So instead of calling it an RNA polymerase, which is used for transcription since it's making DNA, we call it a DNA polymerase instead. And the DNA polymerase uses an existing strand of DNA to replicate it just using the base pairing rules that we have for DNA. And let's just look at this slide right here. All right, so here is an existing double strand of DNA. It is unzipped by what kind of molecule? A helicase, right? And then a DNA polymerase binds to the strand, and it's going to bring nucleotides, right? Deoxyribonucleotides. And what's going to base pair with adenine right here? It's going to be thymine. And then what's going to base pair with guanine? A cytosine. So these will be added, and when it's added, a new strand of DNA is being made. Now we say that this is semi-conservative replication. So what the heck does that mean? And what's really important in this molecule? Okay. We see that the new DNA molecule that's made, it's double-stranded. Notice that it is a complete and unmodified, unaltered strand from the old DNA molecule, and one completely new strand. All right, so the old strand is acting like a template to make a new strand, and so there is high fidelity in replication. As long as the old strand doesn't break anywhere in the process, then it can be replicated with 100% fidelity, right? No information is lost. And let's look at this other strand, this other DNA molecule that's being made. You can see that the new molecule is part old strand and part new strand. So we call that semi-conservative replication. So a new DNA molecule is composed of one completely new strand and one completely old strand. And this old strand is never broken apart because that's going to cause a mutation. Right? So the old strand is never broken, and it's used as a, what's the key term there? It's used as a template to make a new DNA strand. All right, so that means then, right, when you have a template, if you have a template for something, how many exact copies can you make over and over and over again? Yeah, a lot. You can make, you know, thousands, millions, as long as you don't wreck the template, right? If you're going to make some clothing or something and you have a template and all you have to do is cut out the material, as long as you don't cut the template, right, you can make as many pieces of clothing as you want from that, right? So that's important about replication. We call that semi-conservative. Okay, let's talk about the cell cycle. And the cell cycle, right, I think we're going to talk about this one right here. All right, in our bodies, a human cell, here's the nucleus. In a human cell, how many chromosomes do we have? Anybody know? You probably have to take a biology class. in order to know this, and I recommend that everybody do take a biology class, because there's a lot of biology you don't learn in anatomy and physiology. Cool stuff. But somebody said, that's not any darker, but 46. Okay, 46 chromosomes, and they got a special arrangement associated with them. They're actually arranged in pairs, so you have, 23 pairs of chromosomes. All right, but we have a process where we take one cell, and then all of a sudden, it can produce two cells right here. And in these cells, they have 46 chromosomes as well. All right, so now you can tell me what this process is called, and we'll label some of these cells. All right, so this is what we call the parent cell. And these over here we call daughter cells. All right, and what's the difference between these two daughter cells? They're exactly the same. They have the same number of chromosomes. And you could think of them in science fiction parlance, which would be, what are these cells? They're clones of each other because they're exactly the same. All right, and what's the difference between these daughter cells and the parent cell? And again, there's nothing, no difference between them. This process is what we call mitosis. And so you might be wondering, well, gee whiz, what's the function of mitosis if it's just producing the same kinds of cells over and over and over again? This is a form of reproduction. So if I ask you for the function of mitosis, just don't say reproduction, because mitosis is reproduction. All right, but what's the function of this kind of reproduction? Yeah, because there's some cells in your body that don't live forever. They die. They get worn out. And one kind of tissue in particular, what's one kind of tissue in your body that dies pretty rapidly? Yeah, your skin. All right, the stratum basale is undergoing mitosis all the time, replacing skin cells that rub off. All right. And so that's a very proliferative kind of tissue. So proliferative tissue is one that's undergoing mitosis. There's another one, too, that I'd like to use. And that is red blood cells. Red blood cells don't have a nucleus. They're anucleate. There's no room inside of that cell for anything but hemoglobin. All right, so when they become damaged, since they don't have a nucleus, they can't repair themselves. They can't build new proteins because there's no place for. What should take place? What's the first step in protein synthesis? First step is transcription. So a red blood cell can't initiate transcription because there's no nucleus there to get things going. So they only live for about 120 days and then they die, which means a lot of them die in your body every second. How many die every second? Anybody know? Okay. Between 2 and 3 million. Every second, die in your body. So, what does your body have to do so that you don't become anemic? You got to build 2 to 3 million every second. So, you're busy building red blood cells. Somebody should calculate how many you built during lecture, right? So, no one's ever told me that as an excuse as to not paying attention because they were busy building red blood cells. But that's a good one. I'll have to remember that one. Okay. All right. So this process, mitosis, is important for two reasons. One, to replace what? Old or damaged cells. To replace cells that get lost for whatever reason. That's one good reason. What's another good reason? Okay. And somebody said growth, and I like that reason a lot too. So these are the two important reasons that stick in my mind, because a good way to think of that is, how did you begin life? How many cells were you when you began life? You were just a single cell, right? When an oocyte from your mom united with a sperm from your dad, right? What do we call that process? Everybody knows. That's fertilization, right? That's fertilization. And does anybody know the name of that cell? It's got a name. Oh, great. Some people have taken biology. It's called a zygote. It's called a zygote. A single cell product of fertilization is a zygote. And we were all zygotes at one time. But if we were zygotes, right, still, we couldn't come to physiology class and listen and take notes and that kind of stuff because we'd just be a single cell. So mitosis is important for that single cell to, double in size and triple and quadruple. And now we're trillions of cells, right? Not just one cell. We're trillions of cells. and we can do all those things. And so mitosis is important for that process. Okay. See if I have a diagram. Here's a good diagram of the complete cell cycle. Most of the cell cycle is composed of what we call interphase. An interphase is a growth phase, and it's a phase in which the cell goes about its daily life, what it's supposed to be doing. If it's an endocrine cell, it's going to be secreting hormones, right? If it's a muscle cell, it's going to be contracting, right? And that happens during interphase right here. We have some phases, some parts of interphase, but in all cases, you should see that there's growth taking place. Like in G1, certain organelles replicate themselves, like the centrioles. During the middle phase of interphase, we call S, that's for DNA replication. How would you talk about, what's one way you could talk about DNA replication? What kind of replication is it that describes some of the molecular mechanism? It's semi-conservative replication, right? So you got one old strand and one new strand being made, okay? And then the final phase of interphase we call G2. That's the final growth phase where at this time all the organelles should be replicated inside the cell and the cell is ready to undergo mitosis. So here we have now mitosis, and there are a number of phases in mitosis. Right, and you got to know these phases and what order they go in. Probably, well, in anatomy we talked about this. And remember, mitosis has IPMAT. The I stands for interphase, and P is the first phase of mitosis, which is prophase, right? And then metaphase, anaphase, and telophase. So let's see what kind of pictures we have. Do we have pictures of these things? Some. I guess this is good. All right, in prophase, what happens? You should know some bullet points of what happens during each of these phases. Notice that the nuclear envelope has disappeared, and the DNA now is visible, so it's gone from an extended form to a condensed form, and now it's in chromosomes. You can actually see underneath the light microscope, and the centrioles have migrated to opposite poles of the cell, and microtubules have formed between them. We call that the spindle apparatus. And the chromosomes have just a random orientation all over in the area where the nucleus was. Okay, so that's prophase. And then the spindle apparatus pushes and pulls the chromosomes that they line up exactly in the equator of the cell. That's the next phase. We call that metaphase. Guess what meta means? Right there in the middle. Okay. And then during anaphase, the chromosomes that are replicated, We call these replicated chromosomes right here, the two parts to them, sister chromatids. The sister chromatids start to separate, and now we could call these daughter chromatids because now they're separated and they're migrating to opposite poles of the cell during anaphase. And then during telophase, the daughter chromatids are pulled all the way to the centrosome complex, and the cells start to pinch apart. That's the last phase of mitosis, okay? And then the cell pinches apart into two daughter cells. So on this diagram, it's a little confusing because I see where cytokinesis is inserted into this diagram. Cytokinesis is a process that separates organelles and cytoplasm into two daughter cells, right? And that happens within telophase. And that's good for this class. Certain cells, cytokinesis might actually begin in anaphase under certain kinds of conditions. And you know what? Scientists will be talking about this for the next probably 200 years. When does cytokinesis really begin? Right? It all depends on the cell and conditions, et cetera, et cetera. But in this class, you should say that cytokinesis is embedded in what phase of mitosis? The very last phase, which is the telophase. Yeah, I'll try to make it as clear as possible. What the concept I would like you to appreciate is that when a cell is undergoing mitosis, maybe there are two functional areas within the cell that are separating. There's the DNA that's being separated into two daughter cells, and then there's everything else in the cell, namely the cytoplasm, which includes cytosol and organelles. So think of mitosis as the separation of DNA into two daughter cells. That's mitosis. But the separation of cytoplasm into two separate cells is not mitosis. Say that it is cytokinesis. Okay, so try to order it like that in your mind. Cytokinesis is the separation of cytoplasm into two cells. The separation of chromosomes is mitosis. And cytokinesis happens within mitosis. Okay, so yeah, it's a little strange to think about that way, but I think that's good. All right, so look at this chromosome right here. What can you tell me about this chromosome? It has been replicated. We still call it one chromosome, but remember, there's two copies of it. They're connected at this centromere, some central region. So these we call chromatids, sister chromatids. You could call them sister chromatids if you wanted to. And the chromosome, the chromatin is condensed. And the proteins and structures that make up the centromere, sometimes we call that the kinetochore. All right, so maybe you might be familiar with some other terminology. All right, so this is the shape that a chromosome has to be in before prophase begins. Okay, so we talked about all that. Oh, here's some really nice diagrams. All right, I can see condensed chromatin right here. The nuclear envelope is gone. So this would be a nice example of prophase. There's still just what? A random orientation of chromosomes here. And this you should recognize really easy. This is the easiest phase. That is metaphase. And then the sister chromatids are being pulled apart during anaphase. And then during telophase, this cleavage furrow starts to form and the cytoplasm gets separated into two daughter cells. So the phase of mitosis is telophase. And what else happens during telophase? Yeah, this cleavage furrow is separating the cytoplasm. That's what we call cytokinesis. Okay. Oh, I think we talked about centrioles and centrosomes. Telomeres. I don't know if I'm going to say much about telomeres, but they're the tips of chromosomes, right? The telomeres are the tips of chromosomes, and every time DNA is replicated, some of these telomeres disappear. Some segment of a telomere disappears. And eventually, when enough of a telomere disappears, then that cell is bound to die as a result. So you probably don't have any DNA in your body from when you were first born, okay? Because it eventually goes away because of the deletion of these telomeres exactly, right? And that just keeps the DNA fresh that way. Okay, meiosis. Meiosis is a little bit of a different kind of process, and I will say a little something about meiosis. All right, the big difference is, well, we start with the same kind of cell, but now we end up with something different. Okay, through the process of meiosis, instead of ending up with two daughter cells, we end up with four cells. And the big difference is the number of chromosomes inside these cells is actually cut in half. It's reduced in half. All right, so now we got what? 23. And we got 23 in here. And we've got 23 over here. All right, and 23 in this one. And so this is not mitosis. This is what we call meiosis. Okay, and so this right here is what we call a germ cell. And these cells over here are what we're going to call gametes. All right, so these cells usually don't grow up to be human beings, right? But what's the good of these things right here? In humans, we have two kinds of gametes. Females produce oocytes, and males produce sperm. All right, so let's just say we have a male over here that's producing a sperm. How many chromosomes are in this sperm? Because the sperm is a gamete produced by meiosis, it's going to have 23. All right, and then if that sperm bumps into an egg, what do we get again? We get the single cell with 46 chromosomes, right? That's called fertilization, and this guy here, or gal, is called what? A zygote. That's a zygote. And then the zygote gets big by what kind of process? Gets big by mitosis, right? Okay. All right, so the inner workings of meiosis. If you have some questions at the end of the chapter or in the on the web questions, go ahead and look at them. But I think that's the detail that I'm going to talk about meiosis in, okay, which I think is plenty good for your test. What else do I want to say about meiosis? I think that's about it. Okay, so that's it for this chapter. Oh, I did want to say some other things, but that's okay. I think we're good. Maybe later. All right, so now we're skipping ahead to chapter 6. Oh, here's a sign-in sheet. Just sign it real quick and pass it around. All right, so here's a little bit of anatomy, and then we'll get into some physiology really quick. The extracellular environment includes all constituents of the body outside of cells, right? So intracellular compartment, that is what? All the material inside cells is about 67% of your total body, and that's made out of water inside cells. The extracellular component, we call that the extracellular fluid. 33% is what? Outside of your body. Of all that outside of your body, 80% is interstitial fluid. And that interstitial fluid is contained in a gel-like matrix, which we just call ground substance. 20% of the extracellular component is actually extracellular fluid that makes up plasma. Right, but plasma really is part of the matrix of connective tissue because blood is really a connective tissue, right? But that's kind of a interesting designation because blood plasma actually flows around through various parts of your body. Okay. All right, so the extracellular matrix is just a network of, could be precipitated collagen and elastic fibers, right? But it could also be a different soluble form of collagen that acts like a gelatin to hold water. And you have fluid continuously moving out of your cardiovascular system, flowing through the extracellular space, bringing nutrients and oxygen to the living tissues of your body. Right? And then where does this fluid go? Does it get trapped in your body? Anybody remember from anatomy what happens to this fluid? Okay, it is reabsorbed back into the cardiovascular system at the distal end of a capillary, but not all of it is. It's picked up by the lymphatic system, and then the lymphatic ducts take it back to a subclavian vein on either side of your body, and so it's basically returned to your cardiovascular system. Okay, well, how do molecules get transported from the extracellular fluid to the intracellular space? Because there's something that is separating these two spaces, and that's the plasma membrane. The plasma membrane is what we call selectively permeable, or we could say semi-permeable. That means that it allows certain substances to move across the membrane, but not all kinds of things. So what kinds of things can move across the plasma membrane very easily? Okay. And think of in terms of the, whether it is hydrophobic or hydrophilic. Because what's the inner part of the membrane? It is those fatty acids which are hydrophobic. So only things that are hydrophobic can actually diffuse through a plasma membrane without help. So lipid kinds of molecules can, right? But hydrophilic molecules cannot because they can't get through that lipid area. All right, so there are many kinds of molecules that have transporters or channels through the membrane that allow them to move through the membrane. So sometimes we call it carrier-mediated transport when it involves a specific protein transporter, right? Or we could call it non-carrier-mediated transport when it occurs by a process we call diffusion right through a hole in the membrane caused by that protein, and that hole is what we call a channel, a membrane channel. So some molecules that can move through this way would be hydrophilic molecules like sugars and various ions like sodium and potassium can move through the membrane if they have these carrier molecules, right? But otherwise, no. Right, there are two general ways that something can move from one location to another or across a membrane. One way is called passive transport, and that requires no energy. It's a process that just happens automatically, but things can only move in one direction, and it requires something for that to happen. It requires a gradient. That means that there has to be an area where the molecule exists at high concentration and another area at low concentration. All right, so if we have my hands are in two different locations, and let's just pretend this one is high concentration and this is low, molecules will automatically move down a concentration gradient. But as a concentration gradient disappears, guess what happens to passive transport then? It stops. When there's no concentration gradient, passive transport stops. There's got to be a concentration gradient. All right, but that still means things can move about. They can go from one area to another, but if they're going to move when there's no concentration gradient, or maybe it could go from low concentration to high concentration, something is needed. And that is energy, in the form of ATP. Okay? And that's the most direct way of doing it. We call that active transport. So how did you get to school today? Was it passive transport or active transport? Okay, most cases it was active transport, unless you hopped a ride with somebody and slept on the way into school, which would be wonderful, right? But probably you had to drive yourself with a car and spent gasoline and all that stuff, right? So that was active transport. Okay, so let's think about a solution, because our cells are made with a solution. So a solution has two components to it. It's got the solvent, and it's got something we call a solute. The solvent is what? The watery part. It's the fluid part of a solution. And I was going to ask you that question. What is the fluid part that we're dissolved in? And that is water. I just said that. And what would be some examples of a solute? Okay, salt is in our body. Glucose is in our body. Proteins are dissolved in our body. Even lipids, right? So in a cup of coffee, what's the solvent? It is water, and what's the solute? Depending on your particular aesthetic, it might be a lot of coffee, maybe even coffee granules, all right? And maybe some cream, sugar, that kind of stuff. Those would be the solutes that you have in there. Okay. So what have you used as a solvent today? What have you used as a solvent today? Water, for sure. Everybody has probably eaten something, right, with water. Anybody use any other kind of esoteric solvents? Okay, no? Like any kind of special cleaning fluids on your clothes? Anybody take an organic chemistry lab, maybe used acetone or something? Or if anybody put fingernail polish on today, the solvent was acetone. Okay, that's what that pigment is dissolved in. All right, what kind of solutes have you used today? Maybe salt, right? Maybe sugar. Maybe some methylated xanthines like caffeine or something, okay? And the major solvent in your body is water. And we talked about some important solutes. What is a minor solvent in your body? Wow, why did I put that down?
Why could I think of a minor solvent? A solvent is a fluid, is fluid that something else dissolves in. Okay. Well, okay, I think I have an idea. Think of a plasma membrane. What is that inner part made out of? It's, fatty acids. And it's very, very fluid in there. All right, so things that are hydrophobic can actually dissolve in the plasma membrane and actually exist within the plasma membrane. And so that's actually a new realm I think people are going to start thinking of in science and medicine, because there are many processes that happen even within the membrane, but what are those substances in there? They have a totally different nature compared to the substances that are dissolved in water in the cytoplasm. Right? And we're going to actually look at some of those things. So a minor solvent in your body is actually lipid molecules, oil molecules, but only other molecules can dissolve in that component of your body. Okay, things that are hydrophobic. So what can dissolve in this minor solvent? Maybe give an example. Well, there are certain hormones that are lipid hormones. Like, for instance, maybe you should know a lipid kind of hormone in our body. Like, and the precursor is cholesterol, so steroid hormones. Okay? Because it's lipid, they can exist within the plasma membrane or different lipid components of our body. All right, so that is really a minor component, but it's becoming more and more important to realize all the time. All right, so what the heck is diffusion? Does it require energy? No, it does not require energy. All right, but it has to go from high concentration to low concentration. So there doesn't have to be a membrane there. So this dotted line doesn't really represent a membrane. It just means two locations in this particular container. So there's going to be a net movement of these dots from high concentration to low concentration. And when the dots are completely equal in these two different areas, what happens to diffusion? It stops. Okay. And the reason why these molecule moves, does anybody know why these molecules really move? Did you talk about that in lab yet? Okay. There's a little concept, and it has to do with temperature. All right. So as the temperature decreases, how do you feel? You feel cold, and as the temperature increases, you feel hot. But what's really happening there, as the temperature changes, right, these molecules change their motion. So molecules are in motion all the time. As the temperature increases, their motion increases. So temperature really is a measure of physical motion, right? But it's a random motion, but molecules are bumping into each other, right? And because molecules are in motion, they have this molecular mixing associated with them. All right, so it's due to temperature. Diffusion works because of temperature. So if we increase the temperature of something, guess what happens to diffusion, or the rate of diffusion? It goes up. And as we cool something down, the rate of diffusion goes down. And as a matter of fact, if we get to absolute zero, which no one has ever been able to do anywhere yet, then all molecular motion stops. Everything is completely frozen. There's no molecular motion whatsoever. All right, so molecular motion is responsible for diffusion. All right, so nonpolar compounds readily diffuse through a cell membrane, right? Because they're hydrophilic molecules, hydrophobic molecules, they can get through the plasma membrane. But some small molecules like CO2 and water can, because some cells have channels for water. Right, so oxygen can enter the cell as long as oxygen is at a high concentration outside and low concentration inside. And then what does this cell produce? What do we exhale out of our bodies? CO2. Our cells produce CO2 when we get energy out of a glucose molecule, for instance. And then CO2 can diffuse out. All right, and the reason why it diffuses out of a cell and out of our body is because what's the concentration of CO2 in this room? It's very, very low. It's really close to zero. Okay? And so when our bodies produce CO2, it just leaves because of that concentration gradient. And oxygen enters because oxygen concentration in this room is really high compared to what's inside of our bodies. Okay, so that's how diffusion works. Okay. So here we have a nice phospholipid bilayer, and here we have a channel protein, our protein channel, but we can see that it is closed in this particular case, and in this case down over here, it is open, so we call this a gated channel. And in order for hydrophilic molecules to move across the membrane, even down their concentration gradient, they have to have this membrane channel to get through this lipid region within the plasma membrane. All right, so cell membranes are impermeable to charged and most polar compounds. All right, can't get through. All right, but lipid molecules can go through. So what kind of membrane is this one right here? It allows some things to go through, but not everything. So we call that selectively permeable or semi-permeable membrane. Okay. So what are some things that affect the rate of diffusion? It's related to, of course, the concentration gradient. Right, as the concentration gradient increases, guess what happens to the rate of diffusion? It increases as well. And as the gradient disappears, the rate decreases. So diffusion is what we say directly related to. Right? So if the gradient increases, diffusion increases. It's directly related to. It's also directly related to the permeability of the membrane. Right? If there's a lot of channels, a lot of material can move through. And it's also directly related to temperature. As temperature increases, there's more molecular motion, more mixing, diffusion increases. Right? And it's also directly related to the surface area of the membrane. So as the cell surface area gets bigger, there's just a bigger doorway for molecules to move through. So what structure that kind of is like an organelle that we talked about that increases the surface area of a cell, and so that enhances diffusion of molecules?
Microvilli.
Yeah, kind of look like a cilia, but it's a smaller stuff, right? It's microvilli. So it's just the convolutions on the cell surface that increase the surface area that increases diffusion. Right? Now there's something that slows diffusion down as it gets bigger. And we say when something goes the opposite way, it is inversely related. Right? And that is molecular weight. What's molecular weight related to in terms of a molecule? How heavy it is, and how heavy it is really a representation of how big it is. Right? So as the molecule gets bigger, it slows down in terms of diffusion. So as a molecule gets bigger, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It goes down. Right? So my thumbs are pointing in different directions. We say that is inversely related to molecular weight. Okay. All right, so there's another kind of process that is passive. We call that osmosis. All right, what are the three necessary criteria for a process to be considered osmosis and not just simple diffusion? All right, so let's take a look at this. And I got the answers right there, but let's talk about it first. I'd have to stand on my head to read the answers. All right, so osmosis is the net diffusion of water across a selectively permeable membrane. So that's it in a simple sentence, but you really have to appreciate what that means. So osmosis is only, okay, in terms of biology, the water molecule. But what is water in a general solution? What part of a solution is water? It's the solvent. It's the fluid part of a solution, right? So osmosis can pertain to any solvent molecule, but in biology, the solvent molecule is always water. So in biology, we say osmosis is one criteria is that it's got to be the water molecule that is moving. And how does it move? It moves by diffusion, which means what? From high concentration to low. And then there's one last criteria, right? There has to be a selectively permeable membrane across which the water molecule is moving. So if it's missing one of those three components, then we can't call it osmosis. If it's a sodium molecule moving, can it be osmosis?
No.
If it's water just moving in a beaker without a membrane, can that be osmosis? No. Right, it's got to be water, and it's got to be moving from high concentration to low, and it's got to be moving actually through some kind of membrane. And in lab, we have an artificial membrane, so it's osmosis, but in our bodies, of course, it's what? A living membrane, the plasma membrane. Okay. And so water has to move from high concentration to low concentration. Now, this gets a little confusing sometimes, because when we say moving from an area of high concentration to low concentration, you always have to remember what molecule we're talking about, if it's the solvent concentration or the solute concentration. So you always have to focus on what molecule somebody is talking about. All right, so let's take a look at this diagram right here. So we have this water molecule. What side of the membrane, left or right, is the water molecule at a higher concentration on? It's on the left. Right, so water is very, it has a high concentration on the left, right? But this is what we call a dilute solution, because it has very little solute molecules in it. But on the right-hand side, right, this is a more concentrated solution, because it has more solute compared to the left-hand side, but that has what? Less water molecules. So which way is water going to move in a net direction? It's going to move back and forth, but more is going to move from left to right down its concentration gradient. All right, so even though this is a more dilute solution in terms of water, it's what? Water is more concentrated on the left compared to on the right. Okay. All right, so that makes some interesting properties develop. All right, so here we have some kind of membrane, a selectively permeable membrane, and we'll set it up so that on the left-hand side chamber, we put 180 grams per liter of glucose in this chamber over here, and then what do we have on the right-hand side? We double the amount of glucose. So where is water at a higher concentration? Okay, it's higher on the left, right? So it's going to move from high concentration to low concentration through this, and this is a selectively permeable membrane because this glucose is too big to get across it. There are pores in the membrane, but it can't move across. So that's a nice definition of a selectively permeable membrane. So would this be a good example of osmosis? Water can move down a concentration gradient, but glucose can't. So this is a good model for osmosis, right? Because we have a nice selectively permeable membrane. Well, now, when water moves across, what happens to the volume of this chamber over here? And let's just say that this membrane can slide back and forth. As water moves over, it's going to push this membrane over to the left-hand side. Okay? And that's what happens to our cells all the time. They can shrink, they can expand, depending on water concentration, because most cells, even though there's a phospholipid bilayer right here that prevents water, there are special water channels in them that we call aquaporins. So you should know that what's the name of a water channel that allows water to move across the plasma membrane? It's an aquaporin, right? And cells can adjust these aquaporins to fit the needs of the cell. All right, so let's think of osmotic pressure. All right, this is a pressure that develops when, right, in this particular case, there's a pressure that develops over here that pushes the membrane to the left. Osmotic pressure would be the amount of pressure that would be required to push this membrane back to its original location. All right, so that would be, or the force that would be preventing any change in volume. All right, so if we were to have pure water over here, and a glucose solution over here, water for sure is going to want to move over, but if we apply a pressure on this membrane, we can stop this change in volume, right? And what's that proportional to? It's proportional to the solute concentration. Okay, so that's what we call osmotic pressure, and in lab, you're going to witness some effects of osmotic pressure. Did you do that? Did you look at red blood cells yet? Did you change the shape of red blood cells? No. Okay. Well, when we start next time, let's start here with molarity and molality, and maybe you want to look over these definitions. okay, over the weekend. Yeah, and Thursday. Yeah. Oh, today's only Tuesday. So Thursday, we got a lecture on Thursday. All right, we're going to talk about tonicity. No, let's not skip. Let's not skip Thursday. Don't forget the sign-in sheet. You come back on Thursday, I'll let you know. Okay.